This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about social media and podcasting relating to mental health, two themes very close to our hearts. But for now, we'll start off with some stats. First, a study from the University of Pennsylvania found that high usage of Facebook, Snapchat, and Instagram specifically increased feelings of loneliness. The study also found that reducing social media usage can actually make you feel less lonely and isolated, whilst improving your overall well-being. And I wanted to start off with that one because it's something that I think we're getting more and more used to, hearing statistics like that and how social media isn't actually always so great for us socially, despite what the name might have you believe. And yet we're also in a time when we're relying on it in so many new ways during the pandemic.
Absolutely. It's a real contradiction, really. I mean, I guess overall the message would be to try, like with everything, and bring some balance into your life. Easier said than done, because what balance have any of us got right now, to be honest? I found I'm on not always necessarily social media, but my phone, which, again, WhatsApp is social media. There's group messages and Zoom going off, you know, different things all the time. So I am on it a lot more and constantly checking. But I do really like that research. You engage in other things, potentially, with what's around you in your environment, and really maybe start to even engage with yourself rather than almost being a bit dormant and just giving your whole self to a world that's not even really real, I guess.
I get what you mean. I mean, I'm just after watching The Social Dilemma, which is a Netflix documentary.
Yeah, I'd recommend it to anybody. What did you think?
So I would also recommend it, with a note of caution, though. It is very intense. We're all aware, I think, at this point, of the broader issues that can come from social media. Obviously, we've talked about it in terms of mental health before on the podcast, with some very popular episodes. But this documentary goes a layer below that even, and looks not just at how we're interacting with it, but how advertising influences it as well, and how we're very used to the idea of algorithms ordering the content which we see. But generally, I think we feel safe to assume that those algorithms are for us. They're to show us what's most relevant, what's most interesting. And increasingly, as these things get more and more monetized, it's more to do with what the advertisers want to show us, as opposed to what we're likely to engage in, you know, on a purely social level.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. You've got to be in the right, maybe, state of mind and not overthink then what you see, because there's quite a lot that are quite shocking, actually.
Yeah, it was quite shocking. I did spend a lot of the following day thinking about it, going round and round in my head. And that is the difficulty we find ourselves with, that social media is so normalised. It's such a big part of our day-to-day lives. At the moment, it feels more like a vital commodity than ever. And yet it's also worth remembering that it's not the same as the real world. There are other things at play, including, of course, how we put ourselves across, you know, the ways that we're filtering our own lives and putting up certain things. But equally, we know it can be a big issue with news as well. And the next stat is that 48% of the US and UK consumers use social media to read more news as a result of the pandemic. So more than ever, we are relying on social media for our news, but it's also important that we remember the biases that can come into play there, and the fact that we'll be coming across news sources that we may not be familiar with or may not be as creditable, or we're seeing certain news stories shared that are a reflection of the views of the people that we follow. And so you can sometimes feel like you're in a little bit of an echo chamber where everyone on your social media agrees with you, and then in the outside world, or even in your own family, people can have very different points of view, and you think, how did we end up with such different ideas of what's happening?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess, proceed with caution when it comes to social media. I love social media. And I remember watching a documentary once about the benefit of social media to this young child who felt completely isolated at school and really found a place on social media where there were other children like him and built an amazing kind of global network and changed his life. And that was quite a few years ago when I watched that. And I remember thinking, wow, you know, don't diss social media again, like it's so amazing. And, you know, but over the years, obviously, we see the downsides to it. And so I'm always in the middle with it, really, I think, and having young children myself and trying to school them around it without really condemning it. I mean, they see me go on it. Everybody goes on it. You don't want to be like, don't go on social media. But at the same time, like, there's so much caution that needs to be applied, I think.
Yeah. No, it's really tricky. And you're right, it can be so incredible for connecting us as well. And that's why I'm particularly pleased to talk to the guests we have today, who are fellow podcasters, and they're both from a journalism background, so they can see all the different ways in which this interacts. And social media is a big part of their work, not just how they put their work out there, but also how they stay up to date with what's happening in the news. And yet they're also people that are very well placed to know how biased journalism can be, and that you can't always trust that a headline, for example, is an accurate summary of an article. And yet so often people share based on the headline they read.
We've been having quite in-depth discussions at home and within, I guess, my network around journalism, particularly following the tragedy of George Floyd's death and, you know, what's proceeded in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement. And it's delicate, as we know, and these conversations are sensitive. But depending where the journalist sits, because I guess the topic is something that's very close to home, maybe I'm kind of hypersensitive to it as well. And it's really created this discussion around, obviously, we know that journalism should be neutral. But certain newspapers and the way that you read and certain applications online relating to news, you really kind of get a sense of maybe where that particular journalist is coming from. And actually, there's been some articles that have been written that have been quite damning and quite disturbing, actually. I guess when we think about social media, we don't always think about the news aspect of social media. But as you said, you know, that's so important.
And that's something that really came through in that documentary, The Social Dilemma, as well, that because it's all algorithm based, it's based off computers' interpretations of our behaviour, there's not actually that human recognition of what we do and don't like a lot of the time. So if articles really annoy us and we're replying with, you know, how Facebook doesn't just have a like, you can do an angry face or a sad face now, that still counts as engagement. And so we can end up in this trap where we keep being shown articles we actually don't like, or a publication that we disagree with keeps coming up because from the algorithm point of view, we are engaging with it. And so it must be relevant to us.
Absolutely.
And that's the thing that's crazy about it. And, you know, when did engagement become more important than the social side and how we're feeling and how we're interacting with each other? It almost makes me feel like social media, maybe it needs a new name now. But, you know, primarily it should be there to keep us engaged with each other. And the nice thing, I guess, that's been happening at the moment is that we have this technology at our disposal, so we are able to stay in touch in a way that only a few decades ago would have been impossible. And so I think we've also got to see the silver linings there. Even with podcasting, it's a good example. Here we are able to communicate and stay in touch and literally figure out the pandemic as best we can in real time with the listeners. And that's been something that's been really brilliant for us and helped give us structure. And so I guess maybe that's the takeaway, that being conscious of how we're using social media, how it's benefiting us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also important to recognise that we all seem to have built this expectation around social media, or in fact, maybe its users. And when there are political debates going on, or when something has happened, you know, in society, or there is something, you know, in the news that's kicked off or whatever, there seems to be this real expectation that we expect, you know, the people who are big influencers on social media to have something to say. And if they don't have something to say, then why aren't they saying anything? I guess with social media, I feel like there's this expectation of how we should be interacting and who should interact when and who should post when and why haven't they and why haven't they liked and all that kind of stuff. I think we also need to be really mindful of that, as much as we're talking about being mindful of how we use it, but maybe also what we expect from it.
Mm. That's so true. And it's got to the point where I think a lot of people feel a pressure to almost be their own news corporation. That if I don't share this article that's clearly relevant to my politics, are people going to be wondering about that? You know, or do I have to share certain publications because they align with things I believe in? And, you know, it all becomes very complicated, as if we're not already self-conscious enough at times just posting a photo. Now we've got to think about how does everything we share come across and what does it say about us as a person? And I don't really know what the answer to that is, but maybe being a little bit more understanding and forgiving of each other is a really nice place to start. That we're all doing our best, and the pandemic is a very good example of something that we're all just trying to wrap our head around. I don't think there is such a thing as a perfect opinion on a global pandemic. I think we, for the most part, are doing our best, and maybe that's enough.
Our best is enough.
And one thing that's been nice about doing our best is getting to podcast through this time, which is the same case for our guests today as well. They're from the Mentally Yours podcast, another leading mental health podcast from the Metro newspaper. And the two journalists, Yvette and Ellen, that run it are so lovely to talk to, and I got to be a guest on their show, so you can look out for that if you go subscribe to theirs. It's always interesting doing a interview with more than one person, getting those different perspectives and hearing about their differing relationships with social media, even though they work together so closely. And also their experiences of going into podcasting and what they found of talking about their mental health in the way that we do was, yeah, a really interesting conversation. And it's not just us, you know, podcasting is becoming more and more common. Loads of mental health podcasts are popping up, which is really lovely to see. I get messages from people saying, here's my show, it was inspired by yours, and it warms my heart. Yeah, and I think I talked about that a little bit when I was a guest on their show as well. And so I just pulled up some stats for that. So during the pandemic, there's been a major spike in the launch of new podcasts, including a record number starting in May. So 96,537 shows were added to Apple Podcasts just that month. And wow, the previous record to May was in April at 90,977. So that gives you an idea of the massive boom in new shows during a time when we're so limited on what we can do, that this is a wonderful example of how turning to the internet is leading to so many new creative outlets for people. Mm. And podcasting can just be so incredible. And even when we felt lonely during this, we've had all of you guys tuning in, and that's been really lovely because we just didn't know. We thought, you know, people are out of their commute, they're out of their normal routine. Maybe they don't want to hear a show with serious themes like this one. Maybe they'll be, you know, binging their favourite sitcom instead. I guess, hooray podcasting? Is that my message?
I guess your message is hooray podcasting, but I also think your message is something about another podcast.
Yes, very true. Very good segue. Yeah,
absolutely.
And talking of new shows that are launching in the middle of a pandemic, we have a second show, which we have talked about before, and there's been delays. It's been a bit complicated behind the scenes. And then the pandemic hit, and we thought, we've got this show about relationships. We've recorded the pilot episode back in, I think it was November 2019 now, before any of this kicked off. And as time has gone on, we've realised that actually the related measures to it are going to be part of the story of relationships for a long time. We've seen so many friends have breakups during this. We've seen a lot of loneliness and increase in that. And so I think it's going to be a very different world of dating It already is, but it's going to be even more different when, dare I say, get back to some kind of new normal at some point. The new show is going to be called Dating Games, the Modern Relationships Podcast. Me and Danielle are the hosts on it. The artwork, in fact, I'm not even going to say anything about the artwork. It'll be familiar to you, that's what I'll say. But go take a look at that. The podcast is now live with just a trailer, but it will launch properly on the 16th of October. So yeah, less than 3 weeks away. It's
wow,
exciting, a bit scary. I will include the links in the episode description, so please go have a look, listen to the trailer. If you're feeling optimistic, you can even leave us a rating.
And it's so different. I think that's what's really important to say. So it couldn't be more opposite to Mental. And, you know, we enjoy the conversations and the interviews that we have on Mental. And obviously our listeners know how passionate we are about mental health. But this podcast, you will see a completely different side of Bobby in particular. It's completely different. It will be really funny, really fresh, and really modern, you know, in terms of the discussions that we have around relationships. So, you know, stick it in your fun podcast comedy section of your podcast library, because it will be a really cool show. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm really proud of Bob for what he's done already with its development.
And you, of course. Brilliant co-host, as ever. But no, Danielle's right. I mean, I'm certainly making no promises that we won't talk about mental health. No. But most of the guests are comedians, including some we're very excited about. For me personally, the fact that I got to interview Eilish O'Carroll of Mrs. Brown's Boys, she plays Winnie, the next door neighbour, someone that I've looked up to for a long time. Yeah, so very surreal to get to interview her. So look out for that. Go subscribe now and you'll be all set to hear it first and brag to all your friends about your superior podcast listening tastes. So you've got that to look forward to. The link's in the episode description. For now, we'll have a lovely chat about social media and podcasting relating to mental health with two wonderful guests who you can also find me as a guest on their show. Why not? I'll link that in the description as well. All of the links. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
So my name is Yvette Caster. I'm a journalist and podcaster. The first experience in terms of mental health stuff was when I was about 14. I remember very distinctly coming home from school and I just knew that something was wrong. Now I know that that was depression, but at the time it just sort of felt like not the world was ending, but just sort of like the sun was setting. It was summertime, but everything just sort of felt really bad. Going on from that, I then had sort of periods of needing to lock myself in the toilet and cry, but not knowing why I was doing that. So that was the first time that I sort of knew that something was wrong. And I guess that was my first experience with mental health stuff. Mum was great and she took me off to the doctor and we talked about depression sort of right from then. When I was younger, looking back now, I think actually maybe there was bits of depression in my childhood as well, but that was the really strong one. And then also when I was 18, I had a manic episode. That was sort of the flip side. And now I'm 38 and I know I've got bipolar disorder. So yeah, it's been a bit of a journey. And it's a lot easier to talk about now just because I've sort of been through the ups and downs for several years now. But I think those were the two sort of key initial moments in terms of mental health stuff for me.
For sure. And you've also had a lot of practice via your podcast, which I'm sure helps because that was very well articulated.
Thanks. Yeah, definitely. I mean, talking about mental health stuff on the podcast and also writing about it for different news organisations has definitely brought a new perspective to it. And I've met some really brilliant people who have been through similar things or different things, but also challenging things, and sort of lots of great experts for this massive topic. So it's been a real learning process, really.
Right, absolutely. And I can definitely see some similarities in what you've shared already with my own experience. So for Ellen, how does this compare to your experience of mental health initially?
My experience of mental health started kind of differently because my mum has depression. So I experienced it first kind of secondhand and watching her go through it. But then in my teens is when I started experiencing depression of my own and just incredibly low mood, a lot of suicidal ideation. But because I had seen my mum go through it and seen how much of an impact that had on my family, I felt very pressured to squash it down and not mention what was going on. It's strange because you would think that that would make it more normalized, but it kind of did the exact opposite, where I thought, okay, that's a bad thing that I don't like, and I worry a lot about that. I don't want to be the same source of worry. So for me, that's when depression kind of started. And then OCD didn't actually come until my mid-20s. And then after about a decade of mental health issues is when I finally got help for it, which I do not regret, and I'm very pleased I did, but it took me a long time to get there.
Yeah, sure. And it's one of those things, actually, where ironically, I tend to find when interviewing people, if you have more than one diagnosis, it seems to correlate to you taking longer to get support.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I haven't heard that before, so that's reassuring.
Well, I would imagine in a sort of general sense, it's maybe taking you longer to wrap your head around what was going on. I mean, by contrast, I was also dealing with an eating disorder when I was younger, but that one was so hidden. You know, I had so little understanding, and I quite honestly for a long time didn't even think males could have eating disorders. You know, I'd just not seen that represented in the media. And so whilst I got support with my depression sooner, it took a lot longer to come to terms with actually that wasn't the only issue. But I'm interested to know as well, with the environment you described with your mum, how that was kind of responded to in terms of her mental health at home.
Oh, that's actually a very good question. So my mum kind of came on and off antidepressants. She spoke about it quite openly, but the rest of the family didn't really discuss it. We didn't really talk about this kind of big problem. So for me, I think I just saw it as a source of worry for everyone else. I would often see her kind of come off antidepressants while she was on a bit of an upswing and then have quite a crashing low. And I think watching that experience made me really reluctant to take medication myself for a long time.
Right, yeah. Because it was interesting what you mentioned about assuming maybe that you come from a household where there is experiences of mental ill health and that maybe you could assume then that things would be somehow easier for you. But of course, it's not as simple as that.
Yeah, definitely. I think like the assumption when I say that is, oh, you could just talk to your mom because she would get it. But in that sense, I think it made it somewhat harder because I didn't want to go to her and say, you know, the worst thing in your life that you're experiencing, your daughter is also going through the same thing. Like that felt like too much of a load to put on her.
Yeah. And I think that's really common. And it comes from a good place that parents can really react quite badly in that situation because of their protectiveness. You know, they don't want you to have this thing that's been such a difficulty for them, but they've still got to find a way to prioritize being supportive and creating that kind of environment where you can speak up. Out of interest then, Yvette, with your experience, how did that differ in terms of feeling empowered to talk up about your mental health?
It's quite interesting background. I got lots of support from my family in terms of dealing with my bipolar disorder from quite a young age. Worked together and they were very supportive. When I was 18 and had that manic episode, I went to a mental health unit and they took me there and back and were very sort of supportive. So in practical ways, they were supportive. But it's interesting in terms of the talking about it side of things. I almost feel sometimes that when we're doing Mentally Yours, Ellen and I, I'm doing some sort of teenage rebellion because although my family have been fantastic in terms of supporting me, you know, they're incredible what they've done practically and the time they've given up and all the stuff I've put them through, I guess. They're not the kind of family to talk about mental health stuff around the dinner table or with anybody. It's one of those subjects that is just not said. So they'd never be out in a restaurant and just start chatting about it. Like I say, it is a bit of a rebellion because they're still that kind of family, to be honest. You know, they quietly get on with things and they quietly support me and they're quietly brilliant. But when I'm around for Sunday lunch, or whatever, we never just have a chat about my bipolar disorder. It just never comes up. And also to the point where, like, if I brought it up, I know that it would, like, the subject would get changed fairly quickly. And I don't think that's necessarily, like, a bad reflection on them. I think that's just, they're just that middle class. It's just not really
right. So there's not really a talking about feelings generally then?
No, I guess not really. I mean, we're very sort of, like, talk about your work and talk about what's going on sort of practically.
Mm.
they're all welcome to listen to it. And I sort of share it on Facebook and whatnot. And occasionally I might get a message from a distant family member saying, oh, it's great that you're doing this. But it won't be very specific. You know, I had one nice message from a distant relative, and I was glad that she sort of felt supported and that she was proud of me for doing this as a podcast. But I still knew full well, if we were all together as a big family in an event, we wouldn't have a conversation about mental health. It's quite odd, really, isn't it? I think it's a generational thing as well, maybe, because, you know, I'm a couple of years away from 40 and my parents are quite old and my grandparents are quite old. They're all still quite uncomfortable talking about mental health stuff, really. People sort of think, I think now that, you know, there's this big conversation around mental health, everybody's perfectly comfortable to do it. But actually, I think in certain areas and certainly certain ages, that's not actually the case.
Absolutely. And I've seen that in my own family, that my parents are so much better at talking about it than they used to be. But, you know, it just really wasn't discussed at all at home. And that's particularly strange, given that my parents both work for the NHS. So they're around people struggling with their mental health all the time, even if that's not their particular specialty or responsibility. But I think that might be part of the issue, right? That there's still such a separation between mental health and physical health. It can be easier to sort of shutter yourself off from one side, even though they're just so interconnected. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested to know, in terms of that reaction you've got, something I was really anticipating when we started this podcast and something I was kind of trying to mentally prep myself for was how intense the reaction might be, in a good way. What was your kind of expectation of starting the podcast versus how it actually went? And that's a question for both of you.
Yvette, you can go first.
Oh, okay.
Just while I'm thinking.
Well, I don't think I had huge expectations when I set it up. Ellen and I were both quite sure we wanted to do something about mental health. At the time, I think it was a toss-up between doing like YouTube shows and doing a podcast. And Ellen was very keen to do a podcast, so we did the podcast. And I'm really glad we did, because, you know, podcasts are huge now. In terms of like the response, I think I just thought this would be an interesting way to sort of present stuff about mental health in the media, because before that, I'd been commissioning lots of stuff around mental health. I've been writing stuff around mental health. So for me, it was just another way to sort of get the conversation going, because I think I'd had good responses to stuff that I'd written about mental health online. So that had been positive. So it just seemed fairly natural to do something else. So to do a podcast. But I guess my expectation was fairly low. It was, oh, let's try this, see what happens. But it's been really lovely, actually. We did a live event last year?
God, yeah, a year and a half, a long time ago.
What is time anymore at this point?
I know, I think COVID's completely messed my head. But so we had a live event, and that was really lovely, because it was one of those things where we planned it all, and I still kind of like, right until the day before, I was like, oh God, have we planned this
no
whole thing?
No one will come.
Yes, exactly. I was just like, what if nobody actually comes? Because we've seen the listener numbers, we've got a Facebook group, we know that there's people that do listen to it, but still we kind of thought, what if we're just in this room in the basement of Waterstones and nobody turns up? But they did, so that was lovely. We had some really lovely feedback from that. I had a really lovely chat to some people at the end of that, and that was really moving, actually. And like I said, we have this Facebook group, and it's really nice supporting each other. So I suppose it's really exceeded my expectations, because I just sort of went into it to just kind of see what happened, really.
Right.
So I'm blown away personally, like how many Facebook messages I still get referring to like the early episodes and saying to us specifically, it was really helpful to hear your personal experience and, you know, asking for advice. Or even there's stuff that I talked about in 2017 about, you know, going to therapy for the first time, and people will still message and go like, so how did that go? Like, how are you doing now? And that's amazing, like that people are interested enough and care enough about basically a stranger. I think that's kind of the power of podcasting, is giving that kind of intimate connection.
Absolutely, that it is such a part of people's routine. And that's something I have to constantly remind myself, because what maybe the listeners won't realize is it never really stops being surreal. You know that every time you record, you're sat down in front of a mic and maybe just one or two other people, and almost every person that listens to it is not there. And that always kind of remains quite a strange experience. So I love that you had that live event, and we had one as well in February. We got in just in time before lockdown. You know, it was just so incredible to meet the listeners, because it's one thing to kind of get the DMs and the emails, and you get sort of used to that. And it's so wonderful that people feel comfortable sharing with you. And it's another thing to meet people and them tell you, oh, I listened to this whilst I'm walking my dog, or every Thursday on the way to work. We also had quite a few people that wanted to take pictures of me and Danielle without them in it, which was new to me. But I think it's just,
wow.
it's an audio medium, right? So us being there visually in front of them was just quite novel.
Yeah, that's like extremely cool. I haven't had that yet. Now I'm a bit like, I want that.
Very cool. No one's asked for that yet. But it has been really lovely, meeting the listeners. I chatted to a girl and I remember her saying that the podcast helps her through quite a difficult time. And I mean, that's really the whole point of why we set it up, just because it can be quite lonely, really, living with a long-term mental health issue. So if we can sort of support people at all, or help people feel that they're not alone, that's really what we want.
And you're definitely doing that, no doubt. And it's in many ways such a lovely area of podcasting to be in, for that reason. That for us, there's a way to not get too worried about the numbers and the charts and the whole industry that's really blooming around podcasting, but also becoming increasingly competitive, because we also have the mission element. And that's really cool to just have these stories from people and realizing it really is making a difference.
Exactly.
100%. You go over. Sorry. I'm just getting excited.
I was just going to say, you're absolutely right, though, because I think we're really lucky to be podcasting and chatting generally, or writing articles about this topic, because there's such a nice community around it, I found, on social media, online, and the podcasting thing. I mean, I don't know how many other podcasts that, maybe a food podcast might pair up with lots of other food podcasts. It doesn't seem a natural thing for them to necessarily do, because they're sort of maybe in competition. But I definitely feel like with mental health podcasts, because we do have that shared mission of, trying to help people and hopefully putting something out there that's sort of positive and supportive, there might be a small element of competition. But I think because we're all working towards that goal, it's a lot more collaborative. We've worked with a few other podcasts in the past, and that's been really lovely, because you just think, well, it doesn't really matter which one they listen to, as long as they're sort of getting the support on a particular issue.
For sure. Totally agree. And you're right. It's such a lovely online community to be part of, but also we're all just contributing to one big safe space. And it's so true how interconnected it can feel, and that's a really lovely part about it. So for example, Hope Virgo, you've reminded me of someone that we share in common as having on as a guest, and we were talking recently, and she said at times she feels like she's in a kind of post-stigma world, because she's so used to being in these spaces where she's been invited to tell her story and it's a really supportive environment. And so sometimes she's just sharing parts of her mental health and how she's doing with people in her personal life. And she has to remind herself, oh, this isn't normal for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so incredible. And I think I'm very much on the path to that. And I hope that we all are, because that would be so incredible to get to a place where we just don't even think about it twice. We actually answer honestly when people ask how we're doing, and we talk about it like it's the weather. It's just, why would you not? It would be ridiculous to not acknowledge the weather.
I think the thing is, that's definitely happening, and we are, not to toot our own horns, but we're definitely part of that. Like, even going back to my family members, like, they would never have talked about this before, and now they will say, oh yes, we see you're doing a podcast. And it's just a way to kind of ease people into it and just get that conversation going. And I can see the change happening kind of in my small circle, and that rippling out. It's really powerful, and really, like, quite an emotional thing to think about.
You're right, it's so incredible to see. And I've had some experiences with that which have been quite surreal at times. Like, I've been introduced to a friend of a friend, and suddenly that person's telling me all about their mental health and things they've never actually told the friend that's known them for years. And then they'll look at me like, how are you doing this? what is this witch ability that you get this information and this honesty out of people? But it's being in the habit of making people feel comfortable having these conversations. And I think it's not until, certainly for me, I had this podcast, I realized how much I'd internalized the stigma, that I was always the friend that people talked about their feelings to. But I think there was subconsciously a line which I wasn't crossing, and I wasn't asking certain questions, or if people shared things that were particularly difficult, I maybe shied away from or had quiet stigma reactions. And now it's so great to be in a place where I've shifted so much of that, not only to make other people more comfortable, but I know what a difference it's made to my mental health. And I'm so much less judgmental of when I'm struggling as well.
Yeah, definitely. It's just a relief, isn't it, really, to be able to talk about things openly. And like Helen was saying about the way it sort of ripples out, I mean, I found certainly friends, it's really changed over the past couple of years, the way that they chat about mental health now more. Stuff like sort of our podcast, but also your podcast and, well, all the mental health podcasts, really. It's a really good starting point in terms of having those talks, I think.
Yeah. And you're right, it is kind of infectious. And I've been counting. We have now inspired 7 different podcasts around the world, which is
that's baffling. So cool.
Yeah, and 3 of them are in African countries, which, you know, generally we wouldn't even think that with the cultural and geographical distance that that would be where these kind of messages would take hold first in that way. But it just shows how important this is and what a universal issue stigma is as well. And I'm interested to know, now that you're both in such a habit of talking about your mental health, how has that played into dealing with the pandemic and navigating your mental health during that, and what to share and what not to share?
I was saying this the other week, actually, because we were talking about how we've dealt with the pandemic and lockdown, how we're coming out of it now. I think for me, it's been honestly going back to the complete basics of reminding myself, no, it really is important to talk and be honest about how you're feeling, which I always knew. But I think even when you're in the habit of it and you're literally doing that for work and doing a podcast, you sometimes forget when it comes to yourself. So for me, well, I've seen more people talking more openly about mental health in the pandemic because we've recognized we're all going through the same thing. I think seeing that has reminded me personally that I do need to practice what I preach a bit and be open and ask for help when I need it, basically.
Yeah, because that's not something that necessarily comes naturally. I think even when you're in the habit of talking about it, we can fall into the trap of sort of getting a bit too intellectual about mental health and sort of talking about the cultural effects and the stigma in a very broad way. And actually, oftentimes what people most respond to is you being personal and you being honest about your own experience, right?
Mm-hmm. I completely agree with what Ellen said, pretty much all of that, and that I've had to sort of remind myself in terms of my bipolar disorder, sort of what the basics are, because we had a few people on a week over the pandemic, lots of experts. And what they kept saying was, it's really useful to have a routine to look after your mental health. And the thing is, they were saying this week after week, and I was just ignoring it because I'm the kind of person that really doesn't pay any attention to routines. But then I finally just got the message that has really helped, you know, just basic things. So the same time you get up, the same bedtime, same meal times, having a sort of time at 9 o'clock where I just don't look at my phone. So basically no technology after 9. And then I go to bed a couple of hours later. That's been helpful for my mental health because it's sort of less of a shock to the system. So the experts were right about that. And then, like Ellen was saying, just remembering that I have a long-term mental health issue. So because sometimes in the past, I've been known to literally just take my mood stabilizers and then just get on with things. But I think it's really important to get back to the basics. So yeah, the routine, I do meditation most days, not every day. You know, the exercise stuff, going out for a walk, eating a bit healthier. Like, I started doing a meal plan now, which is huge for me, because in the past I just was completely sort of chaos. I'd plan out like the week ahead, which I never did in the past. But I still had like a moment in lockdown of pure panic where I couldn't get my meds, and it was quite scary. I'm glad that bit's passed, to be honest. But it's been such a strange time, really. I think it's made me a lot more aware again of my bipolar. I think I just got a little bit more emotional day to day on top of the way that it pans out for me. So usually I have 3-4 months of depression, a bit of normality, then 3-4 months of sort of going up again. But on top of that, during the pandemic, I'd sort of find like every day I'd have all the emotions. That seems to have calmed down a bit. But I think looking back on that, that was just because it was just really stressful time, you know, and said to myself, you know, this is a stressful time. And that really helped, because it was just sort of acknowledging that actually, of course, I was struggling a bit because there's a pandemic. But I hope that answers your question.
No, it definitely does. And I think you're right about the getting back to basics. Sometimes we can sort of take that stuff for granted because it doesn't feel like the big grand answer that we want. We want something that will fix it and something unexpected. But so often mental health is about maintenance. And so we had a very similar experience of talking to people, and time after time, it was the same techniques coming up. So, you know, I had to practice my routine. And actually, in many ways, I have more of a routine in the pandemic than usual because I've needed it more. Racing around the place is fine when it's appropriate. For much of it, I've been trapped inside, and you really feel trapped if your whole focus is on the routine that you can't have at the moment. In addition to, like you said, going out, having walks, and just trying to keep some semblance of normality. And the podcast definitely helped with that. We did 12 weeks of coverage related to the first 12 weeks of lockdown. And that really helped us like process it and gave us a reason to try and discuss it every week, because I'm not sure if I would have taken the time to talk about it in depth with anybody. And I think I really needed to.
We definitely also use the podcast to like soothe our own concerns, I think, in a similar way. We were asking experts, like, how do you deal with being scared to leave the house? Because I was scared to leave the house for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And I had an episode about, you know, what to do if your sleep's not great, because my sleep wasn't great because of all the stress of it. So that was really handy. I think it's taught me quite a good lesson in terms of actually reaching out to get help, because I haven't always been great about doing that, but I have actually reached out more to friends and just sort of said, you know, I'm struggling today. When I was struggling to get my meds, I'd talk to them about that, and I hadn't really gone into that sort of depth with a lot of my friends in the past about that sort of stuff. So I think that's been kind of a good lesson.
That's so great to hear. And I think all of us have had this time to reflect on our lives, you know, that for many of us, we're in the lucky position of having not contracted the virus and, you know, hopefully not having had anyone very close to us go through that experience. You know, it is a privilege in a way to get to have this time to focus on ourselves a little bit more. And I think it's necessary and it's appropriate. So do you think there's any reflections that you two have come across of maybe comparing your life pre-lockdown to now as we come out of it, maybe any changes you want to make?
For me, I realized that I need to spend more time outdoors because I've actually understood like that's quite important and it does actually make a difference to my mental well-being. And also I think reading more, which sounds really simple, but like I spent more time actually reading books, especially because I used to always do it on my commute. And then without the commute, I had to actually make time to sit and read. And it was amazing. It was so relaxing. Like I should have been doing this whole time. So I'm definitely going to read more and go outside more going forward.
Yeah, I agree. I've been out for some lovely walks during lockdown, and that's been a real sort of silver lining that there's so many areas near me that I didn't really know existed and I've sort of discovered. In terms of the sort of things that I've been reflecting on, just trying to value people a bit more and sort of, without sort of sounding morbid, just sort of trying to think about spending quality time with older family members and sort of making that time count. So, you know, because of COVID and also because a friend of mine did pass away from it, it's made me sort of think about the importance of the time that we all have, the time that I have left with my grandparents. And also just when I'm spending that time with people, making it quality time. So not just being on your phone, not being sort of half there, being completely there. Because although technology has been great in some ways in terms of getting support from friends and sort of keeping me tuned into lots of stuff, when you then do actually see people, the phone's complete goes away for me now. You know, before it would be out and I'd be doing bits and pieces, but now, you know, seeing people is an event and I really want to make the most of it.
Yeah, and hopefully that does stay, that priority on people, that we've all had this chance to be reminded just how much we need our social connections for our mental health, of course, but also just our general life and finding a sense of purpose and meaning that I think a lot of us had been maybe tricked into thinking was a bit more in our work than maybe it was. So do you think there'll be changes in terms of your work lives?
I hope so. I hope that like I can, you know, reflect on the balance a bit. But to be honest with you, I actually noticed my work-life balance become a lot worse in lockdown, just because when I was working at home, it was a lot easier for me to just keep working late and like not really separate work from home. So I'm kind of hopeful that going back to the office, which we've started to do a bit of, will help me separate it again and actually start, you know, having a solid end to the day and doing activities that aren't related to work in the evenings. So I'm hopeful that I will improve on that, because I think it definitely has slipped a bit in lockdown where it's not necessarily the healthiest thing to be doing.
Right. Mm. And something we talked about on a recent episode about burnout, which was a fellow journalist that was the guest, was how we've come to think of social media as something we do as a leisure activity, and it's actually really not.
Yeah.
Social elements, of course. So it's kind of an extroverted thing to be doing. There's this pressure of feeling like you're going to miss things if you don't check it enough. There's the pressure to be posting good content yourself. And I would imagine for you both in your line of work, that's even more so, you know, that particularly the political elements of social media must be quite exhausting.
For me, definitely. And I think especially the last few months, we had, you know, Black Lives Matter, which was such an important movement. But it's very distressing to be going onto the internet every day and seeing people's trauma and seeing these really heavy, horrific things. And it does feel like you have to be looking at it constantly. And if you don't, you're doing the wrong thing, or you're failing at your job, or like you said, you might miss out on something. So yeah, it's really difficult. And I can definitely see how burnout would happen. And that's something that I also need to work on, because yes, I am on Twitter the second I wake up and right before I go to sleep.
I thought you were going to say I'm on Twitter right now.
No, I wouldn't be so rude. I wouldn't do that. But literally, like, the moment I wake up, before I even get into the shower, I'm checking social media. That cannot be healthy.
Yeah, I know. And it's generally not good news. I mean, pandemic aside, it wasn't good news before this either.
Mm.
And Yvette, is that kind of similar? Are you examining social media as well?
Well, I don't know why I sort of feel differently about it. I mean, for me, social media is really great. I mean, well, not totally, it's not perfect. But I think like something like Twitter for me is sort of how papers used to be. You know, it's how you get the news really quickly. I think if you're looking at it for just a short amount of time to kind of get the news at the start of the day, as I usually do, that's not actually that bad, because it's just you're looking on Twitter rather than watching the TV or, you know, reading through a big newspaper. You know, and I love how immediate it is. So, you know, a breaking news story happens and it's just right there. You know, you don't have to wait till the next day's paper. I do understand about some of the other ones, like Instagram. I mean, I'm a complete failure at Instagram, because I'd post nice pictures, but I'd get about 3 likes. And, you know, it just felt like with Instagram, it was all about sort of showing everyone you had this perfect life. And I don't have a perfect life. So so it's just, I don't know. I just didn't really get it. I mean, I'm having a go at TikTok now, and also failing quite badly at that as well, because I also don't get that. I try not to take it too seriously, any of it. The best advice we've had sort of on our podcast about it is having structure around it. So just deciding, right, I'm going to look at Twitter or I'm going to look at all my social media for half an hour at this time of day, and that's it. And then you're not checking it constantly through the day. I think that's where it can be not great. I quite like Twitter and stuff, especially the little chats I have with people about mental health stuff and just funny stuff.
I like it too. I'm not like, I love social media. I just think that basically, like, you're describing quite a, like, healthy, managed relationship with it, whereas I am not healthy. Like, I'm just on it too much and taking it too seriously, basically.
I think if I'm honest, though, I'm not so great with Facebook now. Like, I go to quite a dark place if I look at Facebook too long, just because I guess that's a bit like Instagram. That's sort of like people posting their perfect families or their perfect husbands and stuff. And then I can get serious, you know, what do they call it? Like, comparison is the thief of joy. And that's so true, because it doesn't matter if I've just written a great piece or I've just brought out a podcast I'm really happy with. If someone's done something brilliant with their kids, I will be a bit like, oh, I've got nothing. So I just try not to look at it now, to be honest. That's my approach to Facebook. But I like the other ones, really.
It sounds like, dear, differing extents, you've both got a helpfully cynical approach to social media. So you're going into it a bit more conscious. And that's
the
bit of advice I gave during the pandemic that people really responded to, was me saying, I'm just trying to practice checking in on how I'm feeling when using social media. So if I go on Facebook in particular, and then 5 minutes later I'm angry, then maybe no more Facebook for today.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. And also, once you sort of learn about the different controls and things you could put in place, like during the pandemic, basically, I got very anxious about everything. And so I just realized that on Twitter, you could actually block certain phrases. So there were a few weeks where I just wasn't seeing the words corona, coronavirus, pandemic, anything to do with it. Because I just couldn't face it.
Were there any tweets left?
There are, you know, maybe four or five. Yeah, maybe that's why I found it easier on Twitter. Yeah, because there's just been sort of less stuff. And then the same sort of thing for Facebook, really. Like, if you're finding that maybe certain friends are great, but are maybe posting things that you don't agree with or are too frustrating, you can stop following them, but you stay friends. So
I think the mindfulness is key. I like what you said, Bobby, about kind of checking in about how you're actually feeling. Because yeah. I think for me, I often go, I'll go on Twitter. Like, that's a fun and relaxing thing to do. But it's not. Like, if you actually check how you're feeling, I would feel frustrated and stressed out. So maybe that's a sign to stop or reduce the time. I think, yeah, just being mindful about, you know, making a conscious decision about why you're doing something rather than doing it as an automatic thing.
I really do hope as we find ways out of the pandemic, people do go to a new level of positivity, that maybe we've all had this reminder that there's more that unites us and divides us, and that we need each other, and that we have incredible services like the NHS in this country. And all of this comes together for a more positive and less divided environment, because particularly one thing I find very challenging on social media, I sometimes call it like retaliation news, where you're getting the news of the day filtered through other people's reactions to it. So then even if you're not following people, you end up finding other people get angry about them on your timeline. And I really hope that that goes away. I'm all for criticism, but the level of aggression that can come up on social media and the tit for tat going back and forth, I worry that that's happening in lieu of people voting and taking action in maybe more constructive ways.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's just not very nuanced, is it? Sort of a lot of the stuff on social media. It seems like you have to be 100% behind one thing or 100% behind another thing. There's no real shades of grey. Whereas if you were having a discussion with friends or a debate, you'd consider all kinds of things. And it does feel a lot of the time, I suppose, on social media that people are very sort of, they've made their minds up already. So they don't seem to have much space to actually think, no, maybe I'll change my mind about this. You know, it does seem to be that people dig their heels in about something. I still get messages for people who don't like the thing I wrote about biscuits and which were the best ones. You know, like people get very angry about all kinds of things. It doesn't have to be sort of politics. And yeah, people get sort of very angry on one side and then people get very angry on the other side. And I'm not sure how useful it is. And also, you know, if you're trying to win someone around to your point of view, I don't think it helps. You're wrong, you're wrong. You know, it's better to have a sort of discussion to get more across. Which is hard to do on social media, really, because people seem very sort of certain of their opinion throughout.
And to sort of round up with a mental health point relating to that, I think it's also vital in regards to stigma as well, that if there's this constant people being so entrenched in their opinions and not being open to change, then how will we all evolve and learn that oftentimes the ways that mental health has been talked about and people that deal with mental ill health have been treated is wrong. You know, that has to be acknowledged, and people need to make changes. And it doesn't mean you're a failure of a person if you've had a stigmatizing thought at a point in your life. We all have. That's what we were brought up with. But that is changing. And we have a whole episode talking about mental health education on your podcast as well, where we'll talk a bit more about that. So for now, thank you so much for joining us. If the listeners want to go find your podcast or indeed your journalism online, where should they go?
So Mentally Yours is on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, and also on Audioboom. So we're out weekly and it's called Mentally Yours. Ellen, do you want to sort of say a bit about your journalism?
Sure. If you search Ellen Scott, or Ellen C. Scott is my Twitter handle, even though we've just, you know, slightly bashed social media, you can find most of my journalism there.
Oh yeah, and I'm on Twitter as well, at Yvette Caster. And we've also got a Facebook page, which is called Mentally Yours, where we just sort of have nice chats about mental health stuff. It's not necessarily about the podcast.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.